Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Hour one and a half. 90 minutes gone by, 90 to come. And Steve Haskin is going to join us ahead of Nick Tamaro and Pat McKenna. And I expect to get Tony in for a visit as well. And wait for a second for Steve. And in fact, it was this week. Speaking of Steve and Secretariat.com, the other day, and there's Steve Haskin. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. You saw me, huh?
Casey sent me the smoke signal. Steve on line one.
I was hoping you wouldn't know I was there, so you could say something bad about me. So
yeah, of course, I do that so often. I'm famous for that. It was just a day or two ago. People put up the Secretariat career finale, right? Just the other day, the anniversary.
The career finale of the Canadian race?
I guess so, right? Is that it?
When you say people put it up, what do you mean?
On Twitter, there was a picture that, you know.
I'm not on Twitter. So I don't,
well, that's true. I'm sure Facebook, too. I imagine Secretariat.com would have had something, too. Anyway,
they're busy. Secretariat.com right now is extremely busy with the Vox Populi Award. I hope you vote. You cast your vote.
I haven't yet. We're all in
an election mood. And he's also busy with his numerous auctions. He's got a big auction that just ended with some interesting items benefiting old friends from this collection of this lady is late Julie Albright, who, to say she was a memorabilia collector would be a gross understatement. That would be like saying that Bill Gates has got a couple of dollars stashed away. I mean, she bought everything you can imagine. Going back to the Seabiscuit War Admiral programs, horseshoes worn by horses that I never heard of. I mean, thousands of things that Leonard managed to get his hands on and went over working with the family. And so they just sold a bunch of stuff at auction to benefit old friends, you know, and the estate. And now there's a huge one coming up that's going to be auctioned off at Leland's. Those are the big items. And Leonard's got a bunch of Secretariat items and a lot of interesting horseshoes and saddle cloths and silks and, you know, from famous horses. So that's what's going on at Secretariat.com right now.
Nice
time for them.
Right. What, you know, what was the, I did see some things about that as well, about the Vox, because I guess some people are trying to, they're trying to write in that crazy wheel.
Oh, my God. Leonard mentioned that to me, and I said, you know, has this world gone completely insane?
Oh, it was fun.
I checked online. He said to Google, I checked online. It's like 8,000 things on this poll. And I said, what is the big deal? I
mean, oh, it was great. No.
That doesn't know how to roll in the dirt? What is the first time that's ever happened in history? Who cares? It's like caught the attention of the nation. Like, I said, are you kidding? And people are writing in this horse, Cyrus.
Yeah.
Because he can't roll in the dirt. He's a foal. I mean, give me a break.
No, I'm gonna confront you on this. It's been hysterical, and despite every attempt of the dam and other horses in their paddock to teach him, he kept lowering his shoulder and thinking about it and you know, trying to mimic, and the videos of it, you know, just became engaging because he came so close and it was obvious that he wanted to do it, but he just wouldn't. And so I'll admit, I found it as adorable as anybody.
Well, I'll have to watch it. I just know about it. I didn't watch any of it. People are writing this horse's name in.
But he's not eligible.
He's not being accepted, considering the fact that the horse is not run. So he's not even broken yet.
I guess he was just
recently weaned, and so he's not going to win the Vox Populi. Let's put it that way. So if you want to waste a write-in vote, go right ahead.
Well, Chris Brown is the guy who put it out, and there was a hashtag Roll Cyrus Roll, and
it is just adorable.
Too. And it's so funny because you really don't think about that kind of thing. The best, of course, is the horses that you watch them take a bath and they get, they get hosed down and get scraped and dry them all off. And then you take them, to cool them out. And the minute you turn your back, they're going to roll, and nothing drives a groom crazier than you just spent half an hour grooming and cleaning the horse, and now he's going to roll around in whatever schmutz he can find. It's very fun.
Well, if you want to see a funny video, there's one. I guess it was put up by the barn, or somebody put up videotaping Tiz the Law, who's back in Florida. And he's in the round pen and watching, and he is literally going berserk in there. And then he wants to roll himself. So he'll dig a hole in the ground. He'll pour at the ground and dig a hole and dig a hole and dig a hole. And then he's about to go down, but he's so full of himself, he literally leaps in the air like somebody lit a fire under him. He leaps up in the air and starts running around this round pen. I mean, he's just going absolutely berserk in there. So obviously the Breeders' Cup didn't take much out of him.
Pretty funny. They do love the round pen. Like anything that gets them out of the stall and lets them stretch and enjoy themselves.
The horse that really went crazy, by the way, this was years ago, that became, everybody came to watch this horse, was Tabasco Cat, who went literally berserk. He would get up on his hind legs and try and like climb over the fence. He had an attitude anyway, and in fact, I have a picture, by the way, which I'm not the most proud of, but I was at the round pen, and where he was acting up and doing all this crazy stuff, and photographers are gathering all around to photograph this, getting up on top of trees to look into the round pen and everything. So I was out there, and Barbara Livingston was out there. And she told me to go, go over and kiss his ass. So I did. I went over and I kissed his ass. She got a picture of it. So I have a picture of myself kissing Tabasco Cat's ass. So, if anybody wants an 8x10 blow up of it, they're $25.
That's funny. You said you guys were considering a few candidates, and then actually I saw the list, and I don't have it in front of me, but it did seem like you got some very viable candidates.
I wrote a whole column going over each one, and a lot of people commented saying, wow, you made such a good case for each one,
right?
That you didn't know who to vote for. I mean, you can make a case for each one. I made a case, obviously, for Authentic, even though, to me, he's not, he wasn't exactly a popular horse, but he did have 5,000 shareholders from my racehorse that are probably going to vote for him. But, the fact that he was able to bring in so many people, common folk, people who had never owned horses before to own a micro share in this horse and, maybe institute a whole new concept on horse ownership for the average person. So you can get the popularity aspect of it there, too. Other than that, he wasn't, a popular horse with the masses because, up until the fact that he won the Derby, he was just a horse. And when he won the Derby, he was just a horse. But this whole thing played up. So, but of course, three of the most popular ones from the comments that I've gotten are Monomoy Girl, obviously, coming back off an 18-month layoff, and all the things she had to recover from to come back and go undefeated as a five-year-old, and now then being sold, and now is going to still be in training. So she obviously is a popular one. Swiss Skydiver, and again, this vote should have absolutely nothing to do with performance in the Breeders' Cup. And Swiss Skydiver, if you watch the start, I mean, she stumbled really badly in that race and got shuffled back to the back of the pack and made a big run in the race and couldn't sustain it. She came out of the race with the back of her foot all torn up, and it was a total mess. But, I mean, what more could you ask for? This filly had placed in like eight stakes at eight different racetracks, ran in 10 straight races at a different racetrack, ran in every single month of the year other than April. But she was obviously popular. She traveled all over the country, California, down south, and up in New York. And so she obviously was popular. And then, of course, there was Whitmore. And a lot of people, a lot of people are voting for him to win the Breeders' Cup Sprint in his fourth try at the age of seven. Now I hear he's going to stay in training still for next year. But I think that was one of the more popular Breeders' Cup victories, when Whitmore pulled that off. So he obviously is a major candidate. And the last one was Tis the Law. And, even though he ended up his career with two defeats, he was a popular horse all year. The resurgence of Saratoga Stable after 17 years and, the memories of Funny Side. And listen, if the Derby was run on Derby Day, there's a good chance he would have won the race. He would have been a huge, huge favorite. He was anyway a huge favorite, but he was probably went into that, into the early Derby better than he would have in the secondary Derby, because he was coming off a mile and a quarter race, which is really not ideal to come back and to go into the Derby in another mile and a quarter race. So anyway, those are the five candidates, and listen, you can vote for either one and make a case for them.
No, it is a good group, and I can see that people would, engaged.
Unlike last year, by the way, when there was nobody to vote for, and people, and the thing is, what happened is that last year, Secretariat.com, they partnered up with America's Best Racing as part of their crazy awards that they have, the best this and the best that, the best farm tour. I mean, all kinds of nutty things. But anyway, they've got a large fan base there. So they joined in, and they obviously added to the publicity of it. But I guess there was nobody to vote for last year, but they wound up voting for Bricks and Mortar. I mean, he was Horse of the Year, but, I mean, he wasn't really he won a bunch of stakes early in the year, and then he was out for the whole summer, and you really didn't hear from him. And he came back in the fall and won the Breeders' Cup. But, Horse of the Year, fine. The Vox Populi, not really.
No, you won.
But this year is a much, much better year.
It's weird how that actually, it is kind of funny that you get the kinds of, folk hero type horses that the public latches onto, and some years you don't. This was a good year. And, the nice thing, honestly, I'm just looking at this. These were all organic, Steve. There's nothing contrived about these six horses. I mean, when you get filly, the fillies and mares, they always get their following. Then you got the 2 3-year-olds, and then you got a horse like Whitmore, who absolutely has got the longevity factor as a gelding, and not to mention, in no small part, Ron Moquette is part of the appeal when it comes to Whitmore, because of
family operation.
How appealing
Ron
he is.
And his wife. I mean, they run the stable together, and they're just nice people. I always loved dealing with Ron and his wife, and they're just great people. And like you said, it certainly adds to it. And listen, there were other horses too you could have put in there. Starship Jubilee. I mean, 7-year-old mare of, $6,500 yearling purchase, who claimed for $16,000,
yep,
winds up winning and placing in 22 stakes, Horse of the Year in Canada, multiple champion, Sovereign Award winner in Canada, and winds up beating the boys in the Woodbine Mile at age 7, certainly can make a case for her, too. And
that's true.
Unfortunately, look what happened to her in the Breeders' Cup. Not only did she stumble, but she threw the rider as well. I mean, that was sort of an ignominious way to go out. But I could have certainly seen her as a finalist.
Yep.
You know, so listen, you look at some of the past years that we had winners. But one year, Rapid Redux won. I mean, he certainly did not win that based on achievement as far in Grade One stakes. Let's put it that way. But you know, he became a popular horse with his long winning streak, and he became sort of a cult hero. Another year, Painter won, coming back, you know, from almost dying from laminitis. He won 1 year. I'm trying to think. Oh, 1 year, Winx won. And I was talking to Len. At first, when I heard that, I said, Winx, I mean, you know, it's not even an American horse. But I said, the fact that Americans voted for her, and the fact that so many Americans stayed up until 1 o'clock in the morning to watch her race, I could certainly see that. That popularity that she had in Australia really became global. The people all over the world watching her to see if she can continue her winning streak. So a lot of reasons you could vote, you know, for Vox Populi. You know, and it was inaugurated by Penny Chenery to basically pay tribute to the horse who was the most popular, who represented the sport well. And, you know, it's a great award, and it's grown in popularity.
Tell everybody, for those that don't know already, how do they vote? How do they participate?
You go on secretariat.com. You'll see it right there on right on the main page. We'll click on to vote. Just go on there, cast your vote, secretariat.com, or go on to America's Best Racing and vote there. It's very simple.
Nice.
And if you want, read my column. If you want to read, read a full description of each horse and what makes their appeal so great.
There you go, Vox Populi 2020. Steve, a couple of minutes to the top of the hour. Let me. We won't talk next Thursday, Thanksgiving, and we'll do some best ofs next week. But what's the plan? You going up to Connecticut, or are the kids coming down?
Well, no, unfortunately. Unfortunately, we were supposed to go to Connecticut along with Joan's sister and brother, but you know, Wes has been teaching in class, like 3 days a week or so, several days a week. So he's been teaching in class, and the last day is like Monday or Tuesday or so. And Mandy just she doesn't want us to come until Wes gets tested.
Yeah.
Can see. I can understand that.
Yeah.
So we're all gonna come the weekend after Wes gets a chance to, you know, once he's tested. Once he gets a negative test, then we'll come, because you know this, it's starting to resurge. I know it's not up your way, but you know, in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, or that whole area, you know, like everywhere else, you know, the winter or the fall winter surge has started, and you know, the numbers are all up. So I can understand her caution. She doesn't want us coming, you know, when Wes has been exposed to his students for so long. So we're going to come the week after, and that'll be fine. And in the meantime, John and I will just go back to our old Thanksgiving feast that we always have, compliments of Boston Market, stovetop stuffing, and Ocean Spray cranberry sauce.
You're gonna kick it old school.
Yes, and of course my tofurkey.
Tofurkey, which you love, exactly.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't go that far. But it's a good. Let's put it this way: if I take the tofurkey slices and I roll it up, and I put some gravy on it, and have some stuffing and cranberry sauce, it satisfies my Thanksgiving turkey need.
There you go. Well, best wishes, and
I'm sure you're going to have your usual feast.
Well, you know, but with limited, you know, yesterday we had Neil Kleinberg. It's become a crazily popular segment when Neil comes on, and we do about an hour of, you know, Thanksgiving recommendations and ideas, and go through start to finish and give people some pointers, etc. Right now, it looks like between the smallest it'll be is 4, and the biggest that it would be is 7.
Okay.
My brother may come and invited Seth yesterday on the air because he's got he's like Richard Gere, he's got nowhere else to go. So
well,
Zach Mayo, I got nowhere else to go.
Yes, well, I'm sure that's exactly the way Seth said it too.
No, he didn't. It was not as sorrowful as that. But
Sure you're going to make your wild and wacky stuffing. You know, all that crazy stuff in it.
Yeah, my mother's original. That Tina absolutely. That's her favorite. She if there was nothing else, if it was just stuffing and gravy, she would be content. It's amazing, actually.
Now listen, don't knock Boston Market's candied yams. We always have to get that.
Just the word candied yams makes me laugh. It's one of those. I think the word yam actually is it's got a fun connotation. Yam.
Well, it sounds a lot like yum. So it.
I experimented this weekend. Yams in general and sweet potato was never a big deal in our, you know, growing up in my Thanksgiving pantheon. But out of respect for those that, you know, that do like it, I've tried the last couple of years. I mean, I've done sweet potato pies the last few years, which are good, which are quite good. I put that recipe up this morning, actually, both at Twitter and Facebook. People were asking about it. And I experimented with a souffle, a sweet potato souffle that I got out of Mrs. Wilkes in Savannah, the boarding house cookbook. And I wanted, you know, I don't like to just on Thanksgiving itself to, you know, try to do something you've never done. Don't do that. Go ahead and
exactly.
Do a trial. Yeah, do a trial run. Especially if it's
key. No experimenting on Thanksgiving.
Exactly. I mean, you
there's
can.
No
I don't think
in baseball, and there's no experimenting on Thanksgiving.
Well, and it you can, as I've explained to people, the Clementine Paddleford, Thanksgiving suggestion of every year trying something, incorporating something new in, and if it's a hit, you continue to offer it. But you need to experiment before Thursday with it. Make sure you've done a run through and that you're happy with it, as opposed to slapping something out there that the first year I went to do the roasted Brussels sprouts about 4 years ago.
That's what I would like. I love roasted Brussels sprouts.
The New York Times had a spectacular and easy recipe about 5 years ago that I incorporated, and it's a big hit. But the first year, actually, I did forget them under the broiler, and they, you know, they pretty much went from, you know, roasted to incinerated. So
I kind of like them that way, too. sometimes you go to a restaurant and have the crispy Brussels sprouts.
Well, yeah, but I don't think that there is a vegetable in my awareness that has enjoyed a I won't even call it a resurgence because I don't.
No,
ever
it's not a
remember,
resurgence; it's a surgence.
Exactly. They were never popular. No one.
Are you kidding? Oh my God!
Nobody wanted.
There was an entire episode of Leave It to Beaver, where Beaver refused. No matter what they promised him everything. He refused to eat his Brussels sprouts. There was an entire segment of Leave It to Beaver on that. Just the thought of the name Brussels sprouts. You go, yeah.
Well, it is funny, and I suppose it's because the way that, you know, until there was some alternative preparation ideas, like roasting them, and all you do in this with this recipe, take about 20 Brussels sprouts, cut them in half, you take about 3 to 4 tablespoons of olive oil, put it in the pan, and when the pan gets the hot and glistening, put the cut side Brussels sprout face down into the oil, and you know, very, very quickly, actually, the oil will more or less, you know, sop up, you know, into the bottom of the Brussels. You also put about 3 or 4, 5 cloves of garlic amongst, just and whole the garlic, doesn't have to be minced up. You can season them, and I'll tell you what, for seasoning ease, I season them with Montreal steak spice, just because it's complete, you know, it's just easy. So some salt and pepper, coarse, and you know, everything else that's in Montreal steak spice. So you do that until the bottom, those cut side, has gotten beautifully golden brown. And then you put it into a hot oven, into a 400-degree oven, for about 10 minutes. And every 3 to 5 minutes, pull them out and shake them and you know, kind of toss them. And they get just beautifully, beautifully roasted. And you, like you said, Steve, you know, some of the leaves will come off. I mean, essentially, a Brussels sprout is a little miniature baby-sized cabbage. Mm-hmm. And so leaves will flake off, and they get crispy, like crisp. You ever have crispy spinach at the Chinese restaurant?
No.
Oh, flash-fried spinach at the Chinese joint, out of this world.
I don't know that.
Oh, delicious.
I have to say, though, there was something extremely sensual about the way you just described that Brussels sprouts. And I'm sure everyone listening right now who's expecting a horse racing conversation is as turned on by that description as I am.
Well, if you like Brussels sprouts, this is the way to do it. And then you, when you're done, you can drizzle some balsamic vinegar on them if you like.
Oh, the balsamic, yeah. You get that in restaurants, do that. They sweeten it up, and they almost like, it's almost like in a barbecue type of thing. It's just, yeah. I mean, you're right. I mean, Brussels sprouts have really made a complete 180 turn.
Well, and then and this will be permanent, because there's people now that are hooked on the Brussels sprouts roasted, and they love them. I'll tell you the item that it came to the fore and is going to fade away just as quickly was this idiotic kale, the mania for kale. Kale is very quickly
kale,
returning to obscurity.
I can't get into it. Everybody,
it's awful.
Now it's kale. And there's salads and this
it's
and that.
Awful.
And kale and that kale. There's something about it that it's not my favorite.
Well, it's bitter and gross, and I don't get it.
No, I don't either.
And I don't mind bitter herb type you know, salad, you know, endive and frisée and the like, but no good. Radicchio, yeah. Casey just weighed in. Kale. It's like the scene, Steve, in My Favorite Year, where are they serving tongue? Are they serving tongue at lunch? Twice they serve tongue, and twice the monologue died. Tongue equals death.
That's right.
Yes.
That whole movie, by the way, was very, very culinary oriented. By the way, the scene where he's trying to teach her how to eat
Chinese.
Dim sum.
Yes,
he's just like stuffing an entire dumpling in his mouth, and
you really know this stuff.
Yeah, the tongue scene. It's great.
There's two things Jews know: suffering and great Chinese food. If you haven't seen My Favorite Year,
that's all you have to do to describe Jewish people.
It's the greatest, absolute, one of my absolute favorites.
The characters in there, the depiction of Neil Simon, who, you know, not talking at all, we're just whispering in somebody's ear.
Yep, everything. You know, well, and it's all
when you think of that crew. I mean, just the characters in there. I thought Joe Bologna was just fantastic as
the
Kid Caesar character.
King Kaiser. There's so much. The Selma Diamond character, which includes Selma Diamond with a cameo. Not only, as the wardrobe lady. That's actually Selma Diamond,
Yeah, well, the thing with her voice, I mean, she's Yeah, she, I mean, she's great. I mean, with that voice, I mean, she's so perfectly cast.
And for those that don't know, Selma Diamond was always the female writer in amongst, you know, with Carl Reiner and
right.
Sid Caesar and with Woody Allen and everybody involved in your show of shows. And for those that are Dick Van Dyke fans, Sally in the writer's room with Maury Amsterdam, that's also a depiction of Selma Diamond.
Oh, okay. I see that. Yeah, I can understand.
Absolutely.
That.
Sally right. is Selma Diamond.
What about the, what do you call, you know, Lainey Kazan is a Jewish mother. married
the greatest.
To a Korean boxer.
The greatest. The Filipino. A Filipino bantamweight.
I meant Filipino.
Rookie Karoka. There was a devastating bantamweight named Rookie Karoka. You're looking at him.
Yeah.
It's the best.
How about the most famous line in that movie?
Well,
where the Errol Flynn character, you know, and he finds out he has to go on live.
Yes.
Do live TV, and he goes into a total panic.
Yep.
He says, I can't do it. He says, I'm not an actor. I'm a movie star.
Exactly. My favorite line may be when Lainey Kazan says to O'Toole, "Welcome to our humble chapeau," and Benji says, 2 years at the Sorbonne, and she still gets it wrong.
What about Lou Jacoby showing up with his wife in her wedding gown?
The greatest. You like it? I only wore it once. What a Sadie, yeah. What a lovely dress.
People out there are going absolutely nuts going into this, by the way.
It's the greatest.
You bring up that movie, by the way.
It's absolute.
To all our audience out there, if you haven't, I know you're expecting a horse racing conversation, but
you know, the
heck
not,
with it. If you
not from me.
Every year, and if you love Sid Caesar and your show of shows and all of that, and all the great writers that wrote for him, and a behind the scenes look at it, and you know the Cameron Mitchell character, you know, like a Boss Tweed type of character.
Yep. We're going to keep doing that because it's funny, and you never kill funny. Well, Steve, this was, as always, we never know where we're going to careen off the exit ramp.
To tell you the truth, I didn't know where we were going. I was going to come on and say, you know, I was going to come on and say, you know, who do you like in the Derby? You know, what do you want to talk about? I have no clue. So, you know, between my favorite year in Brussels sprouts, we managed to kill the whole segment.
And the Vox Populi.
Steve. Yeah, well, we did get some racing in there. So.
Absolutely. Always do. Enjoy the holiday. Best to the kids and Joan.
Well, you get a nice big crowd and enjoy your meal. We'll enjoy our Boston market and make the best of it.
Exactly.
I'll watch the parade. If there is a parade, I guess.
There's not going to be a parade, is there?
I don't know. Is there one? I guess I don't know
if they're going to do a
the virtual parade.
How do you do a virtual parade? I guess I don't know. Well, that does give me the opportunity to tie in the parade and a very important on this date anniversary, Steve. November 19th, 1959, the debut of The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Oh, you're kidding, really? How'd you come up with that so quickly?
Believe me, I'm on top of this.
One of my all-time favorite shows.
The greatest.
You know, the thing is, people look at it as a cartoon. It was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
It bordered on genius.
Well, and it was subversive.
And it wasn't even so much Rocky and Bullwinkle and Natasha and Boris and all of that. It was the other segments, by the way. To come up with the concept of having a genius dog and his pet person,
Sherman and Peabody.
Well, the thing is, you know, I did a whole column on that, by the way, when California Chrome was running. I did a whole column based on California Chrome and his pet trainer, Sherman.
But I'm bumped.
I mean, okay, if you ever get a chance to archive it, it was really funny. The whole thing was based on Mr. Peabody and Sherman.
That's pretty
California
good.
Chrome was Mr. Peabody and the Wayback Machine and another brilliant thing, Aesop's Foibles.
Yeah. The Fractured Fairy Tales. Yeah.
Fractured Fairy Tales was great. And God, what was the character? I'm drawing a blank over there. The rescuing Nell from the railroad tracks.
Sweet Polly Purebred and Snidely Whiplash and the Mountie.
It started with a D.
Dudley Do-Right.
Dudley Do-Right.
Yeah.
Okay, that was such a great show. It really was. You know, the funny thing is that it had two stars in two different segments. It started off as Rocky and Friends, and then became the Bullwinkle Show. When Bullwinkle became like, you know, Fonzie in Happy Days, where he took over the show. But at first it was Rocky and Friends, but then Bullwinkle became so popular that it became the Bullwinkle Show.
I think it debuted as The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle. Maybe.
At one point, I'm pretty sure it was Rocky and Friends. Then maybe it was The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle, and then it was Bullwinkle. Maybe you're right.
I think right at the beginning in 1959. Do a little search because today's the anniversary. Right. On a more serious note, it's also the anniversary of the Gettysburg Address, which you know.
You just happen to have that as the top tip of your fingers too, right?
Well, these are things off my Facebook page and in the Facebook memories. Kind of funny.
I had to memorize that when I was in the grammar school, and I actually did a heck of a job. I had to memorize the Gettysburg Address.
Well, fourscore, and in 2 weeks you can recite it for everybody.
Yeah, right. Or I can do my big thing. By the way, is that when I was in Hebrew school, the rabbi said anybody who misbehaves is going to have to memorize the Hebrew alphabet and recite it to the class. Well, I had a photographic brain, and I went home and I memorized it, and I went into class and did something on purpose wrong to disrupt the class, and he knew nobody could do it. And I got up and I whipped out the I can still do it. I can still go through the Hebrew alphabet from start to finish, but if you interrupt me at any point, I have to start from the beginning.
Because you've memorized it. Well, I can give you Aleph, Bet, Vet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, Zayin, Chet, Tet.
Yeah, well, it goes. Yeah, well, there's a lot more to it than that.
Well, that's as far as I'm going, Steve. I got Nick Tamaro standing by. This was.
Yeah, well, I hope this segment's more productive than this one.
No. The irreverent segment is always popular. I appreciate it.
We're like the bridge between racing segments.
Too funny, Steve Haskett. Everybody, Secretariat.com. So go vote for your voice of the people horse.
Yes, get out there and vote, people.
Nick Tamaro standing by and probably aghast at everything that's gone on these last 7 or 8 minutes. Nick, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I hate to break up a party, but it seems as if I've been thrust into that role.
That's all right. You can get the train back on track, actually, quite a bit. A couple of things we're going to do right away. First of all, what's the what is the Tamaro family? How are you guys fixed for next week?
Yeah, we're ready to roll. We do like a mini potluck. I make the turkey. My parents will make the my mother makes a corn casserole that's very good, and sweet potato souffle. And my wife's parents will bring stuffing and string bean casserole, and I'll make cranberry sauce, and we'll throw something. There'll be something Italian in there, just to make things whole, I would say.
Excellent. Well, best wishes on that front. Let's touch on a couple of topics. I mean, tomorrow we'll handicap the weekend, and there are some good, some nice racing again this weekend. But we're going to look at today's cross-country pick five. Before we do that, and maybe it's a two-part conversation, we could do a little this morning and a little tomorrow. Did you get a chance to go through the BCBC plays?
I think I looked most at how the people who did well, what they did, and I mean, I think there's obviously a common element to it. You know, I think that this year sort of shows you, and you know, the interesting thing is that I've never really known how the top two or three finishers play, and obviously I know the top two finishers very well, so I have a very kind of keen sense of how they play on a regular basis. And you know, Marshall and Jonathan also walked everybody through their plays on the YouTube and podcast that Jonathan did, which is well worth listening to after you listen to At the Races. And it gives you a good sense of what those two guys are good at is they are very adept at just simply making their way through the contest and getting them to the point where they have their big opinion. And I think one of the pitfalls of contest play, potential ones, is that you try and chase your opinion or chase early before you really get to your big opinion, and then that can limit your bankroll at the point in time where you really need the cash. So, you know, they each made some show bets and made some kind of basic win bets at the minimum level. But obviously, Marshall's big bet on Friday was the double from Aunt Pearl to, I'm sorry, from VQuist to Aunt Pearl. And Jonathan's big on Saturday, big bet prior to the final double was the double from Glass Slippers into Nick's Go. So, you know, you want to position yourself to get to that point as best as you possibly can, and they did a great job of it. You know, there were some interesting bets that obviously failed. Dave Portnoy of Barstool Sports, I think, bet $25,000 on Improbable, and, you know, little did he realize that if even he had hit that bet, he would have actually probably finished third or fourth at best, because I think Jonathan was collecting something like $250,000 with Improbable. And if it had come in Improbable Authentic, Marshall would have hit as well, not for nearly as well as he did. So, yeah, there's a lot of things. It's interesting to look at. It's interesting to see how some of the people who've done well in this have played over the years, how they played and, you know, where they made their big play. And obviously there's, you know, plenty of people on it, myself included, who had bad opinions, and that just didn't pan out anyway. But you notice in terms of contest play, and if you're interested in contest play, and believe me, you can take these things and boil them down to a lower price point. You know, Naira does the $250 contest weekly on Saturday cards at Aqueduct, and just because you're looking at races in these BCBC plays where people put hundreds and hundreds of dollars into them, thousands in some cases, even tens of thousands in some cases, you boil that down to the lower level, and you realize that, I mean, if you're going to do well in these things, you have to be pinpoint accurate. Your opinions obviously have to be good, but you have to bet very sharply. And what I mean by that, of course, is that don't hesitate to pound one combination. Like, if you like a certain exact or a certain double or a particular horse to win, feel free to load up, because that's how you're effective in these things. And you know, what you have to be prepared for mentally and financially is that you're going to fail the majority of the time, but when you're right, you're going to do well enough to make up for any of those failures.
Did you happen to go through Matt Kwiatkowski's play? Because there's nothing more tricky than the leader, the first day leader, especially if you know, the first day leader puts up a big six figure, you know, sequence, and he did, and it's not as if, you know, he was obviously kind of waiting quite a bit and picking a couple of spots, but you know what. And if Tom's De Tot happens to win the classic, then he ends up winning, you know. And listen, he was a very good fourth in there, and you know, came home with close to 200,000 combined. Some thoughts about building that lead, and then how to utilize it day two.
Yeah, you know, I've long been somebody who shared the theory, and I find myself walking the streets of Las Vegas saying these during the NHC, and certainly after some BCBCs, that you can't win the contest on Friday, but you can certainly lose it. and he tested, Matthew Kwiatkowski tested the theory that you can win it on Friday. Nobody has ever come into Saturday of a Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge with the kind of lead that he did. And basically everything went right. You know, the interesting thing about him and then kind of about Marshall and Jonathan, too, is that, you know, as we have gradually gravitated from $2 win place play to now live money play being the predominant contest format, what's been difficult for some people that are dyed-in-the-wool $2 win place players is how to take their comfort zone and move it to a live money format. So generally, over the years, your big concern was when a 10 or 12 to 1 shot won, because those were the kind of horses that usually create movement on the leaderboard in a $2 win place contest, but they also would in these live money contests, because a lot of those players were comfortable betting, you know, 300 to win on those horses or 500 to win, depending on the size of the contest, or in some cases, you know, just ask Patrick McGowey, 10,000 to win, you know, and get yourself a big total. But prior to that, nobody really made a lot of headway on leaderboards when favorites were winning. And Matthew Kwiatkowski bet $8,000 on Aunt Pearl and $25,000 on Essential Quality. And not that Essential Quality was the favorite, but he was, what, 7-2? So, you know, that's a big difference from where we were. And you know, the winning double that Jonathan used to propel himself into second was a 9-2 shot and a 7-2 shot. You know, and the winning exacta for Marshall was a 7-2 shot over the favorite. So, you know, it's one of those where everybody else is sort of realizing, like, oh no, now I have to worry when the long shots win, but there's people who figured out how to win with the favorites too. And obviously, you know, that vaulted Matthew Kwiatkowski to a gigantic lead. I mean, I guess the most surprising thing about what he did on Saturday, and by no means am I disparaging his contest play, obviously he had a tremendous contest, he had a huge return, he missed two show bets early, and I mean, I think it's safe to say his plan was to bet very, very conservatively, ultimately to get himself to a point where he wanted to make win bets on Monomoy Girl and then Tom's d'Etat, and that's exactly what he did. So he got to Monomoy Girl with, you know, roughly what he started the day with. I think by that point he had bet like $2,400 and was down maybe $1,400. Bet $10,000 to win on her and doubled up and got himself back to, you know, the roughly $140,000, I think, before he could get to Tom's d'Etat. Now, the $7,000 to win on Tom's d'Etat was going to get him back, what, about $25,000? So he probably figured a winning score in the 150 to 160 range would be good enough. Clearly, there was going to be movement on the leaderboard if Tom's d'Etat won. That was just kind of a projection on his part that would be the right kind of total. You know, I don't necessarily blame him. It's kind of an amazing set of wagers to look at, because in 2 days he bet the minimum number of races. He bet in three pools total, one of which was the show pool, and those were clearly just to, you know, to stay alive. And I mean, you know, I don't know. I'd love to be in a position where I have a $100,000 lead, and I'm trying to make sure that I can sustain it. I can tell you that I probably wouldn't be making show bets. I would probably try and get minimums out of the way. But, you know, it's how he did it. It's how he approached it. And I mean, I think it's unfortunate that he only ended up fourth, but three guys who passed him made pretty damn good bets in the end, and there wasn't a whole heck of a lot he could do to prevent it.
Exactly, and we should, you know, we've been a lot of conversation, obviously, about Marshall and Jonathan, who, you know, had a little separation from, you know, third on down. Dylan Donnelly cannot be lauded enough either, because he's had a spectacular year. Talk about the tour, and the expectation is he'll probably win the tour this year, and you know, we had a nice conversation with him earlier this summer. And, you know, here he is, you know, jumping into the, you know, the bankroll style approach and doing spectacularly well. And he ends up a very good third in here, 136,000 and change.
Yeah, no, congratulations to him. He's obviously had a tremendous year. And you know, he now gets himself to a point where, you know, the funny thing about the tour is that there have undoubtedly been tour winners that prior to getting their check for winning the tour were in the red. And that has to do, and this year was a great opportunity for that, because, I mean, you play these online contests left and right, there's no there's no prize pool. So, I mean, if you're playing them and you're doing well, then you're accumulating a lot of points and you're accumulating a lot of you know, you're helping your standings on the leaderboard, but you're not really making any money. So, you know, that this is something obviously where, you know, Dylan will be well into the black and be doing, I mean, he's obviously doing extremely well. I was actually looking to see where he had earned points. I think he's earned points just about all of it on horseplayers or horsetourneys.com. So, you know, not that there's anything wrong with that whatsoever. That's been the biggest opportunity to qualify so far. But, you know, he had garnered a total of zero prize money from all those contests. Now he's got $100,000 plus in prize money, plus $130,000 bankroll. And look, I mean, he had a very good opinion in the Classic. He bet it very well. When you box, you know, an exacta for, what, $5,000, which is what he boxed the 489 for, then, you know, and you get 115,000-116,000, and then of course he came back and played, you know, another 1,000 on the 9 over 4.8. So yeah, it was good betting. I mean, heck, if Tom Zaytai had been third, he would have won the contest pretty much for sure, because he had, I want to say, I looked, it was going to be about a $1,500 try, 9 over 4.8.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean, he would have easily gotten there. So that was, you know, that was some great betting. And you know, you when you've got the opinions, you really have to maximize them. There was another, I think it was the fifth place finisher, Jason Lane, had a $5,000 straight try in the Philly and Mare Sprint, and I thought that was just a tremendous bet. And he bet a $5,000 straight try 279 and a $700 straight try 276, and of course Bell's the One lost that photo to Serengeti Empress, and that was just your regular $130,000. Photo. This is a guy who was betting the rest of his bankroll in the first race on Friday, on Saturday, having lost $1,800 on Friday, and put it all in play and ended up getting that win. I think he cashed one more ticket on the day. He had Monomoy Girl over Valiance in the exacta, but he didn't have to do a whole heck of a lot. I thought that was, you know, pretty tremendous betting. The sixth place finisher, Brendan Fay, his sheet looks a lot like mine when I do well in these. He made a ton of bets, but his big bet was a Tarnawa authentic double, not quite at Jonathan Kinchin's level, but I mean, he did put 4,000 into it, got a little over 103,000 back. Actually, put 1,100 into the Classic and got 3,300 back. He finished with 107,000. You know, these guys all did well enough in to win almost every BCBC. You know, it was just one of those years where, and I think the preponderance of ADW play probably contributed to it, but it was one of those years where the scores got extremely high, and I don't know if it'll continue to stay that way. It all depends really on the odds of the horses that win the major races late. You know, we saw Joe Applebaum win with about $65,000 in 2016, and that was a Breeders' Cup where there weren't a whole heck of a lot of big prices. I mean, I looked through this for a while to see if anybody cashed on Order of Australia, and I came up empty. So, I mean, it was the logical results that made people really get the job done.
No, I appreciate it. That was great. Nick, let's turn our attention to this afternoon, and we've got two at Aqueduct and three at Churchill as we continue to try to pursue this elusive and somewhat irksome cross-country pick five, and got beat on Saturday in the nightcap, and I wasn't happy. The sequence includes the 8th and the 9th at Aqueduct and the 6th, 7th, 8th at Churchill. Scratch are in, and there really is very little impact. In fact, no impact other than Shy Kitten coming out of the 8th race in New York. Majority of everything else is one horse. Tipsy Gal comes out of the 7th at Churchill. So we're pretty free and clear, and no turf issues either as we go into this pre-Thanksgiving weekend. The 8th at Aqueduct starts the sequence.
Yeah, good race, as you said. Firm on the turf at Aqueduct. The three races at Churchill are on the dirt. This is a really interesting starter allowance race with what looks on paper like a ton of speed. I mean, I know I piss and moan about pace and horses not going to the lead when they're supposed to. But, you know, this looks like a race that almost has to be run at a pretty strong early clip. And, you know, it's one of those situations where you want to, of course, respect the horses that are going to be bet, even if they look like more pace-oriented types. But I think you want to gravitate towards horses that are going to be making up a little bit of ground. You know, I've always felt like there's an element of In Rosario I trust in these scenarios. And I think Overheated had things go against her in a couple of prior starts that figure prominently in her past performances. And if you go back almost exactly a year ago to a mile in the 16th race at this level on the inner turf at Aqueduct, she finished a fast closing third at 14-1. She's not really a huge case winning type, but I'd like to try her as one of the horses I use as a main.
We lost a long.
You lost me. I think I may have lost Steve.
Don't miss a second of thrilling live racing from Aqueduct this fall on America's Day at the Races on Fox Sports. Watch Maggie Wolfendale, Andy Serling, and the entire all-star cast bring you the best of fall racing live from Aqueduct. For full TV listings, visit NYRA.com.
Yeah, I'm back. Sorry, Case. I knew something went awry because I heard electronic distortion and then my connection dropped. So, Nick, I'm sorry. Go ahead. And what did I miss? No? Now there's no Nick?
I'm here. I promise.
Okay, there you go. There you go. Okay. No, it was me. I heard electronic distortion, and it was a precursor to my connection to Casey cutting out. So who did we end up deciding on here?
Yeah, I wasn't sure if you were gone. I kept talking. I didn't say anything bad about you, so I promise. I was talking about Overheated, and I think there are a few other horses that you're going to have to use, including recent maiden winner She Throws Heat. Micro Million is first off a claim by Murdkan Kantarmasi. Mm. This is really not this barn's strong suit, as they're a little bit more inclined with the dirt sprinting types. But, you know, you have one of the horses I was drawn to was Come Storming, first off a claim by Mike Maker. But, you know, she's kind of a needs to be forwardly placed type. I don't really think she's going to get the right kind of trip. I do not like her rider either. I think he's really got to step up his game to stay in New York all winter. He's got a good agent too, so he'll have every opportunity. Princess Fozzie is totally outposted. I think when push comes to shove, I'm mainly using 1, 5, and 6 because I think Kitten by the Sea got a great post on the inside. I'm not completely convinced she's going to be effective without the lead, but one thing about Kendra Carmouche is he's riding with a lot of confidence. Being inside on both of these turf courses, even as the rail comes out, is a big advantage. And so I think that will help her substantially. The first of the cross-country races at Churchill is the 6th, which is a $150,000 maiden claimer. I'd actually love to know the last time a 2-year-old was claimed for $150,000, because this is basically a modified maiden special weight race. I mean, nobody's terribly concerned with being taken for $150,000, and quite honestly, most of the connections in this race would send whoever did so a thank you card. Mean Machine is a second-timer who's been gelded since his debut. I thought he did some running in his unveiling. The inside post is not ideal, but this is a horse who should improve with experience. So Dialed In set a very fast pace going long last time at Monmouth. Now cuts back in distance for Jonathan Thomas. I think you can count on him running quite a bit better. Having that early speed is a big edge as well. Storming Lion, first off the claim by Mike Maker, was close to a hot pace last time going long. Now cuts back. The interesting thing about this horse to me is that, you know, I'm not positive that Mike Maker off of Tom Drury is any kind of giant move up on the dirt. I think Tom Drury does a really, really good job. Yep. And so this is a horse that might be a bit overbet. I'm going to use Hard Asset, who ran in the race at Keeneland, where All Bodes Well was declared a non-starter. You know, drops in for the tag, of course, but this is a horse that receives some support on debut, has a good outside post as well. As far as firsters go, Mount Athos probably has the most win early pedigree. Norm Cassie certainly capable of having one ready on debut. All three foals from the dam were winners. It's a cast a wide net race. I think I'm going to have to use at the very least the 1-4-5-9. I'll probably use the 3 as well as a main, and we're going to try and shop for opportunities to cut things down elsewhere. The 9th at Aqueduct is the next in terms of the sequence. It's a sprint on the turf, another difficult race. I mean, without going overboard about it, the racing the next couple of days at Aqueduct is just outstanding. It's the best racing we've seen in New York all year, and we've seen some good racing. Duress moved prematurely last time and was caught late by Maxwell Esquire. It was not a particularly well-timed ride. This is a horse that's probably going to come from a little bit farther off the pace this time around. He's in very good form. Tom Albertrani's barn is going well also. We saw him win a race on Saturday with Wolfie's Dynagos at a gigantic price. I think you have to use him. I think you have to use Ahead of Plan. I'm not enamored with Ahead of Plan. I think he's been able to take advantage of pretty slow paces in his last couple of starts, and that's what's made him look quite a bit better. I wish that he'd be ridden a little bit more aggressively and try to open up on the field as opposed to really just kind of inching along on the front end. Those are the main horses. I mean, I think it's a chance for you to kind of go a little bit thinner. Duress is supposed to win the race,
yeah.
And I think the way we talked about the first two legs having, you know, more use potential, than this is a race where you can narrow it.
You know, that Lynchburg at 8-1 for Trombetta, I've got kind of as a B in there.
As a rule, I'm a big fan of Mike Trombetta in turf sprints. I think it's one thing that that he does very well.
Yep.
I think he's a very good trainer. And this horse really took a step forward last time going back to the turf. And, you know, it wasn't like Trombetta wasn't trying to get him on the turf. He spent 4 months basically trying to get him on the turf. And now that he's had a couple of opportunities, you know, he's finally getting to show what he's capable of.
The 7th and 8th are the next two legs to close this out, and might be able, Nick, in that 7th, might be able to get away here with just a couple of uses, that Palmita down inside, and I was a little interested in Never Forget from Vicky Oliver as an alternative.
Yeah, I have a Never Forget It scratched, which is a good thing, because I was interested as well. So I have the 3-6-9 coming out in here, Heaven Escape, Never Forget, and Tipsy Gal. And Never Forget, I think, was the kind of was the horse that was going to make this race more difficult than it needed to be, because now I think you just use Palomita and Sequin and you're done with it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It just doesn't look really like anybody else can win. It's only 5/8. Obviously, this is a race that was in the book for the turf and it's being run on the dirt as they try and refurbish the turf course at Churchill a little bit. So, yeah, it just seemed that simple. 1-4 and move on. If anybody else wins, I'm happy to lose.
There you go. I agree.
And then the anchor leg is a really terrific race. You know, I think the interesting thing about this race, of course, is you're wondering how Dreams of Valor is going to perform moving into the care of Robertino Diodoro, whose barn really has not been that great at this meet at all and has not had a great second half of the season. But one thing about Gunnett is that Gunnett has, to me, has always wanted to go one turn. And I know it was against easier competition, but look at the race he ran off the layoff in a one other than last year at Churchill, and then look at the good second to strike that with no pace set up whatsoever at Saratoga. This is a horse that's just been screaming for one turn, and he gets it in here. This is a race that doesn't look like it has a whole lot of speed, so he's going to have to be ridden a little bit more out of the gate. I'm a little surprised to see Julian Leperoux getting on. You know, he's done well in limited opportunities for this barn, but this must be a horse that maybe Asbjørn feels like Ricardo Santana is not a good fit for. He ran a winning race in May at Churchill off the layoff after having gotten a really tough trip in the New Orleans Handicap. And he came off the layoff and made a big wide move around the turn. It was, you know I'm president of the Joel Rosario fan club, but it was not one of Joel's finer rides. And he ended up losing to a couple of good horses. Fearless and Top Seed turned out to be just okay, just fine. So I think Gunnett's going to be very tough in here. I would go so far as to say if you have tickets where you need to single, I would single him. I'd also find a way to use a little bit of Sir Alfred James in terms of Valor. I think Sir Alfred James is dangerous on the stretch to a mile. He's got a little bit of speed. He's clearly better at Churchill, and we've seen Al Stahl's barn sort of wake up a little bit. The horse that you have to make a decision on in here is Hembry, who hasn't been on the dirt in quite some time. He's also pretty camera shy. He's generally more of a placing type, but going back to, I think it was early in 2018 was the last time he was regularly on the dirt, and You know, he performed credibly. He wasn't bad, but he clearly is a better horse on the turf, and Mike Maker's generally pretty sharp. In four starts on the dirt, and he did these for Rudy Rodriguez and Ray Handel in New York, he finished second in a claiming race by a neck at 50,000 and wired a field of starter allowance runners. Now, those two good races, one was in the mud, one was in the slop, and of course, turf horses generally excel on wet surfaces. So Hembree's a big pass for me today. If he wins, he's going to have to really improve.
Now, that's Sir Alfred James, I like a lot in here, and that's for our friend Brian Burns, Mount Joy, and partners, the McLeans, Pope and Mark McLean, and out of their nice Super Phoebe. Send out best wishes to the Burnses. Haven't talked to Brian Burns in a while. They'll send him a good luck missive today. Speaking of good luck to Nick, thanks for the rundown. And did you look at Mouse's race?
I did. I've actually looked at the whole card at Aqueduct today. It's a very, very good card. Yeah, I mean, it looks like a grab bag, right? I mean, it looks like if things break her direction a little bit, there's a chance. There should be a good amount of pace. Hopefully, Mapolka is ridden aggressively. That's one thing Eric Consell has done a little bit more of lately. And, you know, hopefully Benji can get over and save a little bit of ground. I've certainly seen what look like much lower chance 20-1 shots.
Yeah, no, I think you know, her best races have come when she's in the race flow, and he should be able to tuck in behind. It looks like Big Al's Gal is going to go, and of course Mapolka, and you know, kind of set up shop into the turn, you know, behind those two and or whoever else joins them. But I think she needs to be, you know, back forwardly placed. Those have been her best, you know, her win and her board hits have come with that style. So. This actually, I mean, the racing's 20 minutes away. They start at 11:50 today with the time change and with everything else. So good luck to Benji today and the Mouse. And we come back on, we're back Saturday too with Kid Chocolate in the 7th. So.
Oh, very nice. I've not gotten through the Saturday card yet, but it does look, it looks very good. I mean, it's been second year in a row now. The best racing in New York all year came in November at Aqueduct on a day-in and day-out basis.
Well, looking forward to talking tomorrow as well, Nick. We'll do the weekend preview action and when we talk. I appreciate this. Well done.
Sounds great. Thanks, Steve. Good luck.
Nick Tamaro, everybody, and Tam 1215. And we're staying right here. We got about 25 minutes to the top of the hour, and as mentioned, 15 minutes to first post at Aqueduct, and they kick things off with a mile claiming group where Chad Brown is seemingly dangling economic policy for 14 is going to be, I'm not looking at odds, but it's got to be a low number. Pat McKenna is joining us from the communications end of the New York Racing Association. Pat, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Live from the Aqueduct Press Box as we speak. It's a beautiful day.
Well, and I hope everybody is socially distancing up there.
We are properly socially distanced, to say the least.
So that means there's Dave Greinke at one end and Aragona at the other end.
Neither of them are here. As of yet, they may be on different assignments today, but you know, this is a spacious press box.
Yes, yeah. We did a show last year, actually, for the first time. We did the show from the press box.
That's right.
A couple of things. We'll get down. We'll do one from this winter. We'll find a good reason to come down. I forget why I had to come down to New York for something. I don't remember if we were in a race too, but
yeah, you were. I think at least that's my memory.
Yeah,
you had one in. I feel like it was a weekday, and
yes,
yeah, it must have been because you did the show live from the second tier of the Aqueduct Press Box.
I will do it again when the 2 year old, we got this 2 year old Scherzando that is going to debut. If he's debuting on a Thursday or Friday, I'll be down to do it again because I'm looking forward to the baby Nothing gets you excited like a 2-year-old does. Speaking of 2-year-olds, how's your? Might be a 3-year-old by now.
She is 3. She turned 3 on August 20th.
I knew she was the summer, and I knew she was older than 2. So there you go.
There you go.
She's old enough to appreciate the holiday season.
Yep, indeed.
What are the McKennas doing for Thanksgiving?
Not very much. We are going to stay home and heed the advice of healthcare officials and stay very close to home and just have the 3 of us. So I had intended on driving up to the Albany area to be with my family, but made the decision to put a stop to that and to just stay very small. So that's what we'll be doing.
Well, it seems prudent to follow the advice of health professionals.
That's right.
as opposed to people who got their epidemiology degree in a Cracker Jack box.
We'd be in a much better place, I think, if we were following the science and not our own personal opinions about this or that. So that's what we're doing. I'm here at Aqueduct. I mean, just imagine this juxtaposition, right? We're about to kick off the card. I'm looking down, down towards JFK, where there is a large mobile testing center that has been here since April, and thankfully it was relatively quiet over the summer, and now, unfortunately, as we've seen here in the city, throughout the state, and especially in some other states, this COVID continues to be a huge issue. So hoping for the best. I see that, here at Aqueduct, we're obviously continuing to be closed to fans, as is the current requirement from the New York State Gaming Commission from New York State. But it's a concern all around the country. And, as you and I and we talked about throughout the spring and the summer, we're operating and we're proud to be operating to support horsemen, to support this economy, to support the thoroughbred racing ecosystem, while doing everything we possibly can to make sure that we're mitigating risk at every turn.
Well, and as by way of update, and with the move from Belmont over to Aqueduct, talk a little bit about how things have gone and the maintenance of being careful. There's also things going on like the Belmont childcare, the Anna House, and there's areas where the vigilance has to continue. And we haven't talked about this actually in a while. I mean, has the backstretch maintained the strong record of very few infection and so forth?
Yep, we have, and I think in some ways we're in an advantageous spot because our community, especially the backstretch community at Belmont Park, has now been operating with these stringent health and safety guidelines in place throughout the pandemic, all the way back to the early days of March, those dark days in the middle end of March and into April. I think you would be hard-pressed to find a specific group, a subset of the population that has operated continuously throughout this period of time. You saw it at Saratoga, where we put in place those proactive and aggressive testing strategies to ensure that everyone who was coming up to Saratoga from downstate had tested negative prior to their arrival. We saw that meet was obviously conducted without interruption. And, we're proud of that. But as you say, you can't rest on your laurels in this kind of environment. And you just have to remain as vigilant as you possibly can. And it's all the basics you hear about from people like Dr. Fauci, who I just heard in an interview. It's the basics. Wear a mask, maintain social distance, do things outdoors if possible, and stay at home if you're feeling lousy. And you know, that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing in New York. And when everybody is making those responsible decisions, that's how you continue to operate whatever business you're in, whatever you're doing. It's how you make progress forward out of this pandemic. So, you know, that's where we are, microcosm of everything that's happening statewide, but proud that everyone here is so fundamentally committed to doing the right thing when it comes to risk mitigation and managing our way through this troubling period of time.
I mentioned when I said you were going to visit that we also saw in the last, what, week and a half, 10 days, with the closing of the back the stretch at Saratoga, finally another season that, you know, really they were able to maintain horse population up here. We see again, just like last year when the main track got renovated, we see that there's some activity going on. Update us on what that plan is.
Sure. So training concluded up at the Oklahoma on November 10th, and Glenn and his team immediately got to work to remove the cushion in order to do a full and comprehensive assessment of the base of that track, and to then be able to determine what the size and scope of a track renovation would look like. That was the same process that we followed with the main track on the front side last spring. So while we expect, and I think there's, you know, certainly someone with the experience of Glenn could tell you what he expects to find, the first step is to remove that cushion, which we've now done, to figure out what that track needs. And I think the expectation is that this will be a renovation that looks really similar to what was done to the main track, which, as you know, was so well received by horsemen, riders, everyone involved. I think that track now responds to those extreme weather events that we unfortunately see far more frequently in Saratoga and everywhere, frankly, than in years past. I mean, you know, we saw it, you saw it firsthand this summer, you know, when we get those storms that drop an inch of rain in what feels like 5 minutes, the track now responds incredibly well. And it is, you hear people like Nick Peterson, people like Glenn, who know more about this stuff than anyone on the planet. What you're trying to achieve is consistency from day to day, consistency even after some of these extreme weather events. So by getting down to the studs of the track essentially last year, you build back that base and you can address areas of inconsistency directly. And that's what we did. That's what we're doing on the Oklahoma side. And what we started as soon as those horses left and training concluded on November 10th. So, again, looking to do things like install the rider safety rail, which would, these kinds of investments are investments into safety, ultimately. And, you know, this is just the latest demonstration of that commitment, right? I mean, I'm looking out on these three tracks at Aqueduct, these two beautiful turf courses, the renovated main track with the addition of a jockey safety rail. So these are significant projects. We're lucky to have people like Glenn and all the skilled hands that are able to do these year in, year out. But what you'll likely see here come spring and summer is a new and improved Oklahoma training track.
Nice. And of course, you know, the volume and the duration, because typically we open what, end of March, beginning of April, right?
Right around Easter.
Yeah. So so you're looking at essentially a full, virtually 9 months of use, and you know the volume of horses that work over, you know, the track. I got a question I don't think I've ever asked anybody, now that I think about it, Pat, regarding the Oklahoma. There was a period where on the biggest days, on the biggest Saturdays, they used to roll the track and park cars even on the track. Do they do that anymore?
No.
Okay.
I feel like I have a vague memory of that in my former life as a just attending the races. And maybe it's just something that I've heard similar to you, but no, we certainly don't park cars there anymore. I mean, in and around it, sure. You know, sort of down East Avenue, you can picture it, across from the Hall of Fame. That's a parking area, but nothing on the track anymore.
Yeah, and to be honest, that actually shows you how the awareness of of tinkering and the challenges of handling the racetracks, what is involved, because obviously sealing a track like that so the cars could drive on it and then opening it up, you know, the next day for training, there's, as we've all learned, I think, in the last 10 years, inherent issues that are, you know, that are involved with that, with packing down the surface and, what its ramifications. And so it just kind of shows that not a lot more thought necessarily, but there's more complete evaluation of every aspect when it comes to, you know, trying to maintain the safest surface.
That's right. It's a comprehensive approach to this stuff nowadays. I mean, we have these weather stations at each individual track, and the advantage of the weather stations is that we know precisely how much rain has fallen, not at JFK Airport, which, sure, is a stone's throw away, or in the case of Saratoga, at Albany Airport. No, we now know at Saratoga Racecourse, we received, 7/10 of an inch of rain, and the wind speed is this, and that actually dictates how much moisture and Glenn and his team apply to the track, and the way that they're thinking about the overall composition of that racetrack and those turf courses. You know, we can now specifically calibrate the irrigation systems at all of our locations, so that we know exactly how much moisture is going down on these tracks and how much moisture they need. It's little things, it's big things, it's obviously a science. Sure, there's an element of art to all of these things, but it's a comprehensive approach where, like so many other businesses, so many other sports, frankly, you need to use all of the tools at your disposal. And now, with the advancements that have been made, with the expertise that people like McPeterson and Glenn possess, you're making decisions that are so much more well-informed by science and data.
On that topic, I'm not looking to put you in a position to comment. It made me, when you say that, it makes me wonder, are you surprised? I was surprised. I mentioned it this morning at the start of the show. I was a little surprised that Tampa, especially in light of numbers in Florida, that Tampa is going to let patrons, beyond owners, come to the track. New Orleans is not. Fairgrounds is opening without. And in fact, there's already been. I saw also in New Orleans there will be no parades, no crews. I mean, after last year, Mardi Gras, New Orleans had a terrible backlash with illness and fatalities. But I'm still surprised that tracks are, willing to open themselves up to this. And I do know, Pat, that, a lot of people say, oh, well, the casinos are open, so why shouldn't the racetracks have patrons?
Yeah, I think, here in New York, we're treating this in a far different way than has at almost any point throughout this pandemic. They had 8,000 cases yesterday, 86 deaths. It doesn't seem like they're in a particularly strong position to be encouraging folks to be out and about more. That's a state that certainly they approach this from a very different perspective Governor DeSantis approaches this from a very different place, certainly, than Governor Cuomo. But, yeah, it is somewhat surprising, considering where we are, where Florida is, compared with New York. You know, I think that as you see the numbers rise here in New York, certainly there will be measures that will be put in place to further mitigate risk. I think it's clear, though, that that elected officials, that folks who are working in healthcare agencies are looking to be much more surgical and strategic about how they approach these issues. So, you know, a bit more measured than when this thing ambushed us in April, but also consistent with the fact that we are not, you know, there is hope now with these vaccines, and it seems to be a light at the end of the tunnel. But you got to get to the end of that tunnel, and that looks to be spring, early part of the summer. So again, I go back to the original point that I made, and that you hear from responsible folks everywhere. Let's do the basics first. Wear a mask, maintain your distance, do things outdoors, wash your hands, stay home if you're sick. So, you know, each state here has been left to manage their way through this in the absence of leadership from the federal government. So we're doing the best we can in New York, and, you know, here at NIRA we'll continue to be as vigilant as we possibly can be to protect our employees, to protect this industry, and ensure that we can conduct these meets safely and appropriately.
Now, the winter just getting underway. We got the fall meet, and we got, you know, really some big days yet to come, including Cigar Mile Day, December 5th, I think, right? And there's nice contest coming, and, you know, all of us have adjusted to the online play, and, you know, got the Naira Bets contests on Saturdays that have been fun, you know, going back through the summer. And, you know, then there's the TV broadcast, which, you know, continues. It won't obviously continue all through the winter. How much longer is television, the television program, the America's Day at the Races, going to go on?
Through the fall, but this has also been changing as, you know, sports, unfortunately, have,
yeah,
you know,
that's
games
true.
Get moved around. But, yeah, certainly, you know, look for us every day through the end of the fall meet on December 6th, and then, you know, potentially sporadically throughout the winter. But, yeah, incredibly fortunate that we have the strong TV program, the strength of the partnership with Fox Sports, with MSG here locally, and thankfully with Naira Bets, remembering that a New York resident placing a wager through Naira Bets is an on-track wager, meaning, you know, horsemen are seeing much more of that money going into the purse account. We're able to reinvest that money. We were just talking about the Oklahoma training track. That's a good example of the fact that as a nonprofit, we're pouring that money directly back into these facilities that support horsemen, that continue to support these small businesses and the 19,000 jobs that Thoroughbred Racing is responsible for in the state of New York.
Well, looking forward, I'm just looking at the calendar, and December 5th, as it happens, Cigar Mile Day, there's going to be a very nice opportunity. $500 buy-in, $250 bankroll, $250 prize pool. This is Naira Bet's customers, and two NHC seats at the top of the leaderboard, in addition to the prize pool. So very nice. And, of course, each Saturday we got the $250 contest. And we've been pushing this cross-country pick five, which if I don't hit one soon, I'm gonna stop playing. It's driving me crazy. I keep getting beat in the last leg, which there's no worse feelings. But we'll try again. Pat, happy Thanksgiving to you and the family, and I will see you at some point soon. I'll be down.
Look forward to it. Thanks for having me on, Steve.
No, it was great. Pat McKenna, everybody, with some updates on everything in New York, including, you know, maintaining health protocols and keeping the train on the track. And another renovation project to give the Oklahoma surface a refresh. They've already started. The first race is in the books, actually, already. I don't have it on because I'm without my computer. Although I do want to thank. I got a nice email while been on the air, and Tim Connors, thank you. Says that I can plug even if the screen's out, I can plug in to a monitor and make things come alive in the interim until I send it in for repair. Thanks, Tim. Thanks to Pat McKenna, PC McKenna on your Twitter, Nick with the cross country, and some BCBC sifting through plays. Steve Haskin, Bill Downs, Indiana, wrapping up. Don't miss the opportunity on the force out of the straight fire pick six. And Dick Powell started the whole morning off. Good luck today, everybody. Safe trip for Benji and Minute Mouse in the third. And we'll talk to you tomorrow. Weekend preview at the races here, Sirius XM. Thanks.
It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.